And now, on October the 20th, 1973, after all the trials and tribulations of these past 19 years, after all the uncertainties and delays that have bugged its progress, there it stands, in all its shimmering magnificence, the Sydney Opera House, now, at last, complete. A tremendous feat of architectural imagination and structural realization. A monument to its designer and to all who persevered in its construction. Ready now for the Queen to declare the building officially open and to grace it with her royal presence.
In paying tribute to the many people whose devoted efforts and inspiration over more than a decade have combined to bring this unique conception to fruition. And I congratulate the people of Sydney, and indeed of Australia, on this remarkable addition to its architecture and to its cultural and community life. I have much pleasure in declaring the Sydney Opera House open.
You seem to be completely unaware of the Constitution of Australia.
I haven't seen what she said, but let me say I support what it is that she said.
So commit suicide, Tony Abbott.
Look, I'm going to shirt front Mr. Putin.
I was offended by those things. Misogyny, sexism, every day.
And quite frankly, they should shove her and Bob Brown in a chaff bag and take them as far out to sea as they can.
I and most Australians want our immigration policy radically reviewed. I believe we are in danger of being swamped by Asians.
Such a sycophant, a social climbing sycophant, if ever there was one.
You're not saying anything, Tony. I've given you the response you deserve.
But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
They're communists because they shoot their own people, they haven't got a justice system, and they will take over this country.
So, welcome to Convict History on the Pop and Lock Report at popandlock.net. Today we're going to be discussing the Sydney Opera House opening in 1973 and the 1917 Battle of Beersheba. I have with me tonight Michael Smythe, the political editor of The Unshackled. Say hey to everyone, Michael.
Good evening.
So, the Sydney Opera House opened on the 20th of October 1973. And the story of the Opera House is a drama that unfolded for more than 15 years, grabbing national headlines across Australia and pitting the vision of architect Jorn Utzon, a Danish national, against the political workings and the budget of the New South Wales government and the limits of architecture and construction at the time. It reminds me a lot of the NBN in that the original cost and scheduling estimates given were about $7 million and it was given a completion date. It was first proposed in 57. It was supposed to be $7 million, given a completion date of the 26th of January 1963, but it turned out the project would take about 15 years and ended up costing over $100 million.
Well, as Frank Gehry mentioned, it was a building well ahead of its time. I mean, with abstract concepts of construction that had not yet been tested, let alone refined, it added astronomical overheads to the construction cost. And that is what blew out the budget for it so much, unlike the NBN, where there's no excuse for the government's incompetence. But at least with the Opera House, you could actually justify, okay, we went, looking up on it, 1,357%, oh my God, percent yeah, over budget. That's, oh my goodness.
Well, like I said, I mean, if you look at if you scrutinize the NBN, it's about the same percentage-wise in terms of its over budget and even its lateness.
Yeah, but
well,
they're working with an obsolete technology. At least the Opera House you could excuse or even give a pass for, given that the designs were A, not only well ahead of its time, notwithstanding the shilling from Frank Gehry, but the technology just wasn't available then. With the NBN, the technology has been available for more than a decade, and they're still slouching, to put it politely.
Yeah, and so the need for, or I guess the desire for something like the Sydney Opera House basically came about because Sydney grew in its size or its population size quite rapidly from 500,000 to 1.5 million people in the first half of the 20th century. But it was seen at the time that the cultural life was lagging population growth, and in 1947, renowned British conductor Eugene Goossens was appointed to lead the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, and he had publicly called for the need for a world-class concert hall, saying, quote, "We must have an opera house within 5 years. Sydney is taking its place among the world's major symphonic groups. A fine hall is essential if the public is to hear the orchestra at its best." And this idea that government should play a role in and promote high culture is actually something that I really appreciate. And I think that's something we've really lost in the modern world.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously, we're going to draw fire from the libertarians for saying, you know, the government does have a duty to maintain the heritage of our people and our nation. But it's heritage. You can't trust the public sector to do that.
Yeah, well, we can see the results of that today, can't we? The vapid, you know, cultural nihilism and hedonism and all that.
Exactly right. Bear in mind as well, Jack, and our listeners may or may not be aware, but the Sydney Opera House is one of the seven wonders of the modern world. You know, yes, it cost a lot of money. Yes, it was way over budget to the point where it was, you know, way too expensive and probably would have put us into debt had our position not been so, our financial position under Menzies had not been so good. But like I said, the technology just wasn't there to fabricate the material in quite the same way as we do now, or even in the 1970s. That's why it took so long. I think the building of the Sydney Opera House, while controversial and fraught with impediments, was a good thing to build. And the government was correct to say we should build it. You know, we need to take care of our heritage. We can't just rely on wealthy benefactors to provide the funding. I mean, even if we had, you know, it might not still be built.
Well, yeah, and this type of... It's always, there's an incentive these days sort of against that sort of far-sighted project. And at the time, it was commended for its boldness and its far-sightedness when the New South Wales Premier of the time, Joseph Cahill, announced it, which was in 1954. A year later, the Premier announced an international competition to design an opera house to be built, which was at the time occupied by a tram depot. And it is sad that we don't see... I mean, at the moment, we see a lot of just, you know, the NBN being a typical example, infrastructure projects, because we're just so... Our governments are lagging behind in keeping up with what we need. And so there's not even any real scope for governments of the day to... attempt any bold cultural related projects like this, or at least not ones that are sort of unifying. They're always ones that are more obsessed with the multicultural and the sort of divisiveness and the, oh, this will be the cultural thing for this little group and this will be the cultural thing for this little group. There's very little like that unites the whole country.
Exactly. And even thinking smaller, Jack, there's nothing for long-term planning for infrastructure, let alone cultural planning or restoration or revamping of heritage. Because as I commented to a friend of mine last night, politicians are slaves to the electoral cycle. And so they have no desire to think beyond the short term. They're stuck in a default myopia, which hampers any real nourishment of the spirit of society, of infrastructure, let alone of culture.
Having said that, though, the Opera House did become a contentious political football in the mid sort of 60s. Once it was, people were getting a bit anxious about the fact that it was well past the 1963 promised opening year. And after 24 years in power, the Labour Party was defeated by the Liberal Country Party coalition, and the leader of the Country Party, Davis Hughes, became Minister for Public Works. He refused to accept what he considered was Utzon's chaotic approach to managing the Opera House, and eventually decided to cut funding so that Utzon was unable to pay his own staff. And on February 1966, Utzon met with the minister to discuss the $103,000 that he was owed. Hughes refused to release the funds, and so Utzon was forced to offer his resignation, which Hughes immediately accepted.
And of course he did.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, being a bit cynical, it's just, that's sort of the classic Liberal Party thing. Let's just undo whatever Labour's proposed and turn it into a political football. But the public was not happy, and over the next few days, there were protests on Sydney's streets by architects, artists, and unionists calling for Utzon's return. Attempts were made to broker an agreement between the architect and the government, but to no avail, and Utzon left Sydney on the 28th of April, never to return to the city, and he never saw his completed work.
And more's the pity. Yeah, of course, you mentioned the cynical consideration that we make, oh, Liberal will undo anything that Labor does, and Labor will undo anything that the Liberals do. It's sad to say, but it's true. The problem with Jorn Utzon's dismissal as architect is that he resigned. If he hadn't resigned, he could have dug in and said, no, hang on, you owe me this because this is what I was contracted to do. I am owed, I am legally entitled. But he didn't fight it. He didn't fight it. He just handed victory to the Minister for Public Works, Davis Hughes. And as a result, very few people know that it was him who designed it. So a few years later, what was it, 66. So 7 years before it was able to be completed, he was being stonewalled and obstructed. So he's like, you know what? Stuff this, I'm out. And then he left, and he never returned to Sydney, so you can never see the completion of his work, and that's actually a little bit sad. I mean, when did they open it? It was October 1973, wasn't it, when Her Majesty the Queen opened the Sydney Opera House?
20th of October 1973 was the official Queen Elizabeth II opening.
Exactly. So, yeah, and they didn't even invite Utzon, for goodness sake. You know, yeah. It's kind of a slap in the face. So who did they end up crediting? Just the government of New South Wales?
That seems to be how it worked.
So they basically made him a non-person.
They essentially the Queen and all officials tiptoed around sort of using his name. They, you know, they were still crediting it as this bold sort of expansive and crazy new design that was going to, you know, bring us, you know, that was going to modernize Sydney and create all this sort of cultural, what would you say, gentrification, I guess, in Sydney. But yeah, they were very careful not to name Utzon. They do now have an Utzon room, like a room in his honor.
Well, that's something, I suppose. I mean, they could do a little bit more.
Well, it's interesting because Utzon sort of entered the competition as like a bit of a throwaway thing. Like, he just designed this quick... If you look up YouTube clips or I suppose you can just Google the original sketch design that he did, and it is sort of just like a throwaway little thing that wouldn't have taken him much time, and it was almost just like he just thought, oh, you know, I'll just play around with geometry, create something that'll really stand out, and that's basically, you know, why it was picked. I actually fall into the camp of thinking that the Opera House is a bit ugly. What do you like the design?
Honestly, no. I was going to say it is an ugly design. It's not aesthetically pleasing to me. But at the same time, while Australia is a European nation in the sense of its foundation, its laws, its values, etc., we're also an organic offshoot thereof, of the British Empire. And as such, we can afford to do things a little bit differently. It does distinguish Australian ethnic Europeans from European Europeans, if you catch my drift. I don't hate The building, it does look ugly. I'm not gonna lie, Jack. It looks ugly.
Please don't lie to me.
But at the same time, no, of course not. But at the same time, I can see why it won the prize. I mean, you know, the way he formed the shapes was, like I said, it was ahead of its time. And the acoustics are still pretty decent inside the opera house. Now, what you want in a concert hall or an opera house is to have excellent acoustics.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, notwithstanding the eccentric design of Jørn Utzon, you have the fact that the acoustics are still very good. In fact, the acoustics are excellent at the opera house in Sydney, and you've got to respect that. You know, I mean, there are lots of places in the world that have uglier buildings that have much more historical significance or much more cultural significance. So I don't know. Yes, it's ugly, but I don't hate it.
I don't really hate it. No. Yeah, no, I quite like that we have it. Like, I appreciate that Sydney has its own opera house. But yeah, I dislike the exterior visual aesthetic of it, though I do appreciate the, like what you're saying, the way that it was designed internally in terms of the acoustics. They are really nice, and people who haven't been there really should check it out. It's wonderful to attend a concert there. Without sounding too pretentious.
Nothing wrong with appreciating classical music at all.
Yeah, no, and there shouldn't be. We need to destigmatize that. I totally agree. The loss of high culture and replacement with popular culture is definitely a net negative for society, I think. What do you think of a sort of economic nationalist argument towards it, that we shouldn't have gotten a Dane to design it? That the competition shouldn't have been international. It should have been national, and we should have gotten an Australian architect.
Well, that argument would basically follow that, you know, we should have an Australian building designed by an Australian for Australians. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, I'm a nationalist, of course. But it does sound a little bit kitschy, because Australia is a lot more than just British or any other individual European country. And the fact is, well, at the end of the day, I mean, if you go to Europe, the only thing that gives us away from other Europeans is our accent, the g'day, mate. And that's pretty much the only thing. And that's for people who actually speak like that, not for myself, who was educated not to speak like that. my point is, I mean, yeah, I get the economic nationalist argument saying, oh, it should have been done by an Australian. Maybe it should have, but at the same time, are we going to exclude the designs of other participants that might be better just because they're not Australian? It's dubious. You want something that works. You want something that's functional. You want something that's going to stand out as well. And, you know, look, honestly, I don't think when the Labor government of, who was it? Who was the premier at the time?
When it was first announced, Cahill. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Cahill really differentiated between a European living in Australia and a European living in Europe.
Well, I mean, I guess for the
I don't think he cared, because, well, you know, this is still the days of the immigration and the naturalization and immigration restriction act. So
yeah, I mean, during the 50s, it was kind of for granted that a European architect was going to win it. Like, it wasn't as if they were going to have an architect from, I don't know, China or something like that.
You're exactly right.
So moving on. So on the 31st of October 1917 was the Battle of Beersheba, which I know you're
very glorious day.
I know you're very keen to talk about. So the Battle of Beersheba is a not very often discussed and yet extremely significant event in Australian history, particularly in our war history. So it's been called Australia's first big achievement on the world stage. And in fact, some people, such as historian Jonathan King, have argued that the Battle of Beersheba should be the cornerstone of Australian military identity, replacing Gallipoli. He says this is because Gallipoli was a British-led defeat, whereas Beersheba was an Australian-led victory. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. And before I go into my answer, I'm going to point out a quote that was made to General Ludendorff of the Imperial German Army by one of his aides. Quote, "The British are lions led by donkeys," unquote. The aide wasn't actually talking about the British. He was talking about us Aussies. He was actually talking about us. I mean, you know, the way we fought. Everyone was absolutely staggered by how bravely we fought and how valiantly we fought at Gallipoli, at the Somme, and every other theatre we entered in, but not nearly as impactful as Beersheba, as we say it in English. Actually, my uncle and aunt went over to Beersheba for the anniversary, the centenary of the liberation of the Holy Land from the Ottomans last year, but I digress. My point is that I would agree with King in saying that we should actually consider the liberation of Beersheba from the Ottomans by the Light Horse Brigade as our defining moment. I mean, this is the whole, I mean, if you're a Christian, Palestine / Israel is the holy land of the Christian faith. It's where our Lord was born, raised, crucified, and if you are a Christian, you believe that's where he rose again. The fact that it was under Ottoman as well, but Mohammedan rule, that is Islamic rule, for almost a millennium, notwithstanding the liberation by Godfrey of Bouillon in the First Crusade, was a huge thing. I mean, we Australians, we were a nation of what, 16 years old? Yeah, we were 16 years old as a nation. And our guys liberated the Holy Land from the Mohammedans. We liberated. We did that. The British Empire failed. The French failed. The Spanish failed. Everyone failed. The Catholic Church failed. We, the small little Commonwealth of Australia with only 4 or 5 million people, we did that. We defeated the Ottoman Caliphate.
Yeah, it's actually crazy how tiny we were at the time, and the fact that we we'll go into detail after you're done, but yeah, just the how few we were to, and yeah, as you say, everyone else failed. They all tried and they all failed.
And yet we did it. We defeated the Ottoman Caliphate, which was the successor of an Islamic theocracy in the Middle Eastern world. We did that. No one else. We did that. And the fact is that, because I only heard about it about a decade ago. Oh, sorry, 15 years ago. No, I was in high school. And I wasn't taught this at school. I learned about it from reading a book which was put out by a retired military officer. I forget his name, but he wrote a book called The 800 Horse. And he pointed out, he may have hammed it up a bit, admittedly. He may have hammed it up a bit and, you know, exalted our soldiers, but not without cause. The Turks, who were firing their machine guns at our horsemen, they had the adrenaline coursing through them because they saw our diggers on horseback charging them. They were aiming the sights way too high. So by the time they realized that we were not in their sights, we were there and we liberated Beersheba and ultimately Palestine as a result. And it should be part of the Australian mythos. They're part of the Australian folklore. Absolutely. Sure. So when Jonathan King says that Beersheba should be the cornerstone of our Australian identity, absolutely. Anyone who disagrees with that is wrong, objectively wrong.
Gallipoli is actually quite embarrassing. The more detail you know about Gallipoli, the more embarrassing it really is for the Anzacs, actually.
And that's because the British sent us all to die. Or Churchill, specifically, sent the Anzacs to die. I mean, in fairness to Churchill, and you can cut this out if you want, but Churchill's strategy to take the Ottoman Empire out of the war by sending Australian and New Zealand troops to land between the Bosporus and take Istanbul. It was actually good in theory. Unfortunately, the intelligence was wrong, the intelligence was bad, and we were also up against Ataturk, who, as well as being a secularist, was also a decent general. the strategy was good in theory. It was just poorly executed because the military commissioned officers were, well, how do I put this, egregiously incompetent.
Well, that was a common feature of World War One, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And, you know, that's why the, and well, at least on our side, at least on the Allied side, not on the Central Powers side, but on the Allied side, it certainly was. And the only reason why the Central Powers lost is because they stopped and got drunk somewhere in Belgium. Basically, that's the basically the reason why France did not fall. That and our guys came in and, you know, pushed the Germans back after they were groggy from overindulging.
So,
but that's another conversation for another time.
Yeah, I bet. I better just to enlighten anyone who's not familiar with it, and I certainly wasn't until the last couple of years. This is. I'm just going to read. This is quoting from the Wikipedia entry of the battle. So basically, the Ottoman defenses in the center of the line at Atawine and Hairpin redoubts supported each other as they overlooked the plain, making a frontal attack virtually impossible. Between Gaza and Harira, the Ottoman defences were strengthened and extended along the Gaza to Beersheba road, east of the Palestine railway line from Beersheba. Although those trenches did not extend to Beersheba, strong fortifications made the isolated town into essentially a fortress. The EEF, which is the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, had already decided to invade Ottoman territory before the First Battle of Gaza on the basis of Britain's three major war objectives: to maintain maritime supremacy in the Mediterranean, preserve the balance of power in Europe, and to protect Egypt, India, and the Persian Gulf. Despite the Egyptian Expeditionary Force's defeats, oh, and I should clarify, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force was the Allied force, even though it sounds as if it was Egypt, an Egyptian military force. It wasn't. It was named for where it was to fight. Despite the Egyptian Expeditionary Force's defeats during the first two battles of Gaza, with about 10,000 casualties between them, Allenby planned an advance into Palestine and the capture of Jerusalem to secure the region and cut off the Ottoman forces in Mesopotamia from those in the Levant and on the Arabian Peninsula. The capture of Gaza, which dominated the coastal route from Egypt to Jaffa, was a first step towards these aims. Infantry from the 60th London and the 74th Divisions of the XX Corps, from the southwest conducted limited attacks in the morning. Then later, the Anzac Mounted Division launched a series of attacks against the strong defences which dominated the eastern side of Beersheba, resulting in their capture during the late afternoon. Shortly afterwards, the Australian Mounted Division's 4th and 12th Light Horse Regiments, so the 4th Light Horse Brigade, those two together make the 4th Light Horse Brigade, conducted a mounted infantry charge with bayonets in their hands, which were their only weapons for mounted attack, as their rifles were slung across their backs. Part of the two regiments dismounted to attack entrenchments on Tele Saba, defending Beersheba, while the remainder of the light horsemen continued their charge into the town, capturing the place and part of the garrison as it was withdrawing.
That's right. It was a victory that in most cases should not have happened, and yet it happened.
It's absolutely miraculous, yeah, which was, I mean, which adds to, and then the fact that, like you were saying, the site has such religious historical significance, you can totally see why people took it as some sort of a sign from God that, you know, the Christians were taking back the Holy Land and all that sort of thing.
Exactly right. I mean, liberating it from centuries of Mohammedan oppression, that's a huge thing. And then ultimately leading to the creation of the State of Israel in the 1940s, although that much came much later. And it should be noted as well, both Sir Harry Chevelle, who became Lieutenant General and basically our first full general, and also Allenby, the British general, who was technically the superior commanding officer of the campaign in the Levant. They basically, even though they weren't Catholic, they basically prostrated. They virtually, it was a recount that they prostrated themselves once they entered the holy city of Jerusalem. They gave thanks to God for the victory they had, and they praised him. It's part of, it should be part of our mythos. Well, it is part of our mythos and part of our folklore, but it should be more prominent. Barely taught. It should be taught
in place of Gallipoli, for sure.
Mm. I mean, unless you want to teach everyone to hate the British, yeah.
makes you think, doesn't it?
Makes you think indeed. Yeah, but the thing is, we don't hate the British. We hate what the British incompetent British generals did, but there are incompetent people everywhere. Point is, Bathsheba versus Gallipoli. Tough choice. I think I'll choose Bathsheba any day of the week, any day of the year. It is that simple. Our glorious... And as you rightly put it, Jack, miraculous victory at Bathsheba cleared the way to not only liberate the Holy Land, but also to defeat the Ottoman Empire in the war. And ultimately, the Ottoman Caliphate fell a few years later, ironically, at the hands of Ataturk, who was the bane of the Anzacs at Gallipoli. Go figure.
Harry Shovel is a really, really interesting character, and I would definitely encourage all our listeners to look more into him and the Battle of Bathsheba generally, but I guess the whole that whole theatre of war of World War One is quite interesting.
I mean, even Sir John Monash, you barely hear about him, let alone Thomas Blamey. You know, they don't teach it anymore. It's like the powers that be are almost ashamed of our military successes and our virtues in victory.
Well, he was active. He's been active in a lot of Australian military campaigns. So he was active in the. He was also active in the Boer War.
He was actually, yeah, he was too, wasn't he? But that was also a war fought mostly with British command staff rather than Australian command staff.
All right, well, we hope you enjoyed episode 2 of Convict History. Check out popandlock.net for more analysis and commentary from us. Thank you, as always, to The Unshackled for letting us use their platform. Check out their coverage at theunshackled.net. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.